This is Laura Calkins at the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech, continuing the oral history interview with Colonel Jim Hall and with his wife, Minnie Mae. And again, we're both, we're all three of us sitting here in the interview room on the campus of Texas Tech, and the date is the 24th of March, 2005. And let's continue, Jim, with your permission, talking about your return to the U.S. after your service in the Far East.
Okay. As I mentioned, after completing my 35 missions, I could not come home right away. I got home about the middle of September of 1945 and landed on a troop ship, landed in Oakland, and took a troop ship, a troop train home. A troop commander of about 200 troops as a captain, back to Fort Sam Houston, where I originally entered the Army. And they, after arriving there and resting for a night, they put us in a theater one morning and said, you have two choices. You can either get out of the Army right now, or you can stay in the reserves, and it takes you about 3 days to process all the paperwork to get you in the reserves. Well, I want to see this sweet young thing, so I said, I'm out of here. I'll be home tonight,
right,
which I did. So I went home, and my father, as I mentioned earlier, had automobile salvage business, and he wanted me to come in business with him rather than to continue my apprenticeship as a tile setter. Made my tile setter friends very unhappy, especially the president of the company. And that's another story. But so I went to work for my father, and then the reserve program opened up out of Hensley Field in Dallas, western Dallas. I guess you combination Grand Prairie, but Dallas actually owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in conjunction with the bomber plant I mentioned earlier, North American bomber plant, where Minnie Mae worked. And initially, we had AT-6s, single-engine trainer. And then we got some AT-11s, and they formed a troop carrier wing then, reserve troop carrier wing, with the AT-11s just phasing out and C-46s coming in. So we would fly all kind of missions in reserve, transporting people and or material, and going to the various airborne bases, Army airborne bases, to drop the troops on their training missions, parachuting training missions. And along comes the prospect of Korea. Mm-hmm. So we were all, the wing was recalled into active duty in, I think it is late 1950, early 51. And in the meantime, I had already been recalled on active duty as the motor maintenance officer at Hensley Field on a program called Category R. And that was a commitment for 3 years. It could be finalized either by a commitment for 3 years or by war or by the wing being moved and my inability to move with it. So, but then the reserve wing's recalled for active duty, and I stayed with the wing to Donelson Air Force Base, South Carolina. We were programmed to get C-119s to replace the old World War II C-46s. But I wasn't happy being the prospect of being a troop carrier pilot in Korea. So I volunteered for A-26s.
Here he goes.
It was a little fighter bomber, a real hot little airplane, World War II type,
mm-hmm,
that had their training school at Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, and was accepted. Except that I had to go to the Strategic Air Command Survival School at Fort Carson, Colorado, in February of 1952. And that was a 2-week course. And in February in the Rocky Mountains, it was a very good time to be outside and survive. But it was really good training. They gave us 6 days of classwork classroom study. And I mean, no, they didn't. They had about 4 days, I guess. And then they took us into the field to put this training into practice under supervision. And then, with about a week left, I'll digress just a minute. In those days, the B-36s and all were programmed for one-way missions. If we got in a fiasco with Russia, with the Soviet Union, they would fly and drop their weapons and then fly as far as it could toward the Eastern Europe and then bail out in Soviet Union and hope to be rescued. So this was the premise that we worked on at the school. Didn't have anything to do with my A-26.
This
except
is
the survival
this is,
aspect.
Right, this is SAC training.
Yeah, SAC training. Uh-huh. So this particular morning, about 6 or 7 days before the end of our course, they assembled us on a mountaintop and gave us a guide for each crew, 11-man crew, and said, 35 miles over there is where we're going to supposedly pick you up, land a troop carrier airplane and pick you up behind enemy lines. So you have a plus or minus 2 hour leeway there to get there, or you're out of luck. And snow was almost knee deep. And during the outdoor activities, they had given us regular in flight lunches, which were really good lunches. And in there, they had a can of Hershey chocolate, a little round can. I think it had 3 rounds of Hershey in it.
Uh-huh.
So I saved those back because I saved them back because they were going to, after we left this briefing on top of this mountain, we were on our own to survive with food, except that they gave us a pemmican bar, which is dehydrated, compressed beef. And we shave it, put it in a mess kit with some water, and either build a fire and boil it, or eat it, stir it up and eat it cold. And that didn't sound very appetizing to me,
no.
So I saved these Hershey rounds. And because we were supposed to either catch rabbits or shoot, no, not shoot birds, or trap birds or whatever, and I said, 6 days, 35 miles, man, we're going to be moving, we don't have time set up in a trap. So, we departed, and they had aggressor forces throughout this whole area, the 6 miles,
really,
simulating Soviet military. And if we got caught, then they would take us to an interrogation camp and interrogate us as though they were the real Soviets. And it really got nasty when they started talking about what was happening to our wife.
Oh, yeah.
And our family back home and all of that. They really made it realistic.
They did make it realistic.
They made it realistic. And walking a couple of miles with your hands like this, you can't believe how tired your arms get.
Your hands folded
hands
over
up,
on top of your head.
Over the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I split my group. I was a senior officer. I was a major. And I was a senior officer with 11 people, therefore suggested as aircraft commander. We had Navy mixed in with us. And so I said, guys, we don't want to go as an 11-man crew. It's too easy to track. We're split up in twos, and we'll try to stay pretty well abreast moving toward that point, 35 miles over there. Not within yelling contact. We're not going to yell because these aggressors hear us. Anyway, we got to a pretty lively road, and I can see some of them getting in the ditches. We were down, me and my buddy were down in the ditch down over here. One of the couples way up the way made a run to cross the road, and the aggressors right over there and called them. So then they came along the side and called us too. So we all marched in to the interrogation tent, and we were kept there probably a couple of hours and being interrogated. And then they released us, saying that if you go get caught two more times, you fail the course. So you won't have this training that you need. So that was the only time we got caught. And we got to our destination, okay, within about an hour of the time for pickup. In fact, we just kind of sat back on the outskirts when we knew where we were for, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, waiting until time to get up real close.
So you had to hang back. You had gotten there.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So then they had 6x6 trucks there, 7, 8 these, and took us back to the Fort Carson. It's a huge steak. Your mini steaks is with more.
You'll go back and chopped it. What'd you do with that on your trip?
Oh, well, oh, yeah, okay. Each. I rationed myself. In the morning, I'd have one bite. Lunch, I'd have one bite. Dinner, I'd have one bite. That took 3 chocolates. So during about up until about the 3rd day, I did pretty good. But after that, I just could not wait for that minute when I could take a bite of chocolate. I mean, I became a chocoholic. So after they released us, after we had these good steak dinners, I went down to Broadmoor Hotel, got a room, went to their gift shop, and I bought a dozen bars of Hershey. I laid my bed and ate chocolate on. The next day, on a commercial airplane, going back to Greenville, South Carolina, we stopped in several little places. Not running into the gift shop and grab shop. It took me about 3 months to get over there. I mean,
right?
I really became addicted. Got back there and learned that my orders had been changed. No more A-26s. I was going to go to Kirtland Air Force Base to be in a nuclear test group. Task force, I guess you'd call it. To support the Atomic Energy Commission in their tests out in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. The sole purpose of the base at Kirtland was to support the Atomic Energy, to call the Special Weapons Center, Air Force Special Weapons Center. And they had one airplane of each type that the Air Force were going to marry a nuclear weapon to. Mm-hmm. So they would test on these various tests. So I was the operations officer of this task force, not a part of a base complement, ready to go overseas. I got there in, I think it was March, March of 52. And we left there in July of 52 for, July 52 for Kwajalein Island, where the Atomic Energy Commission was going to detonate a weapon on Inuitok Island. Mm-hmm. Actually, we didn't talk atoll because there are several islands in the atoll, and this was Ugilab, E-U-G-L-A-B, I think. And we were stationed at Kwajalein, and I was operations officer of this task group. And our mission was basically just to support whatever the AEC asked for in the way of transport and accommodations there at the Navy base at Kwajalein. And on the day that this was called Operation Ivy, on the day that the first thermonuclear bomb, Ivy Mike, was detonated, I was flying an old C-47. 30 miles south of Inuitok, and had about 4 or 5 AEC scientists and equal number of AEC photographers. They wanted to, the scientists had just old fashioned navigator sextants to check the ascension of the nuclear cloud as it went up, and the photographers were to photograph it so they'd have a permanent documentary. And we had to actually have on the extra dark glasses to keep the flash from bothering us. But there were 2 other effects, thermal and blast. And we didn't feel a thermal effect, but we felt the blast effect. 30 miles away after, I don't know, a minute, maybe just 40, I don't know how many seconds maybe. And that elevated us just 500 feet, just real quick.
Just like boom. Instantly?
Inside a thunderstorm or something.
It just bumped you right up? What did that feel like at the controls?
Well, all you do there is hold stick forward, kind of keep you from turning like that, mm-hmm. turning straight up. Mm-hmm. So we did that and survived easily. It was just kind of like a sonic boom if you ever encountered one.
Jim, can I ask you some questions about that?
Sure.
Were there other aircraft besides your own that were flying similar missions for photography and
they had
measurements?
They had one C-54 that was configured very similar to ours, more sophisticated equipment and higher level scientists, I'm sure, on it. But the other airplanes that we had at Kwajalein were all our Air Force airplanes that we didn't have B-52 or B-36 or B-47. Had B-47 there, and then a squadron of F-84 Samlers, and the B-47 that was the only one that practiced being in position as though it had actually dropped this device and then made its escape as though the bomb was still in there to see what effect that would have on that airplane in that particular position. And the F-84s were there to take samples out of the cloud on filter sheets, mm-hmm. bring them back and send them back to the laboratory at Los Alamos to be analyzed. Now the B-47 did his mission okay, but when he got back to Kwajalein, the base was socked into a thunderstorm, a terrible thunderstorm, and he didn't have very much fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a small Japanese island of, I think it was Roy, R-O-I, in the Kwajalein Atoll, and we told him, try that, buddy. You can't get in here because there's no radar here, and there's no way you can see it. We can't even see across the room, hardly. Hmm. So he made it next day, you see where he tore up all the old asphalt on those brakes.
Yikes.
And but the next day, we loaded a lot of 50-gallon drums of fuel with a hand crank pump, JP4, and an OC-47. Here I go up to Island of Roy, and we crank all this into that B-47 enough to get him home. And he had JATO, that's jet-assisted takeoff, rockets on the side of the airplane to help it. It was a very high density wing, high load wing airplane, and it took a long runway
to get it up.
To get it off. Mm-hmm. And this little runway, I think, was only maybe 3,500 feet, to 4,000 possibly. Old asphalt. But he made that just fine with the JATO. And then we had a couple of other shots up there that we monitored, not to the degree that we did this thermonuclear, the other were just normal. Had nuclear shots.
Not hydrogen bomb. Uh-huh.
Not thermonuclear. Mm-hmm. So I was over there about 6 or 7 months. Came back to Kirtland. Was then assigned to the base to the base group there as flying safety officer. And there I flew the T-33, the B-25, and then just administrative type flying. And then along came Task Force Castle in 1954, and I was pulled into that task group. But before that, in preparation, I knew I was going to be pulled back in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of the original assignment there, was task group rather than just base people. So I was going to be the flying safety officer for the task group. I've got the number now. One was 132.4, the other was 7, I think. Anyway, for the Castle Air Force task group. And we were going to have a bigger array of airplanes on this one than we did on the Ivy shot. So, and they were going to be at Enewetok because the shot was going to be at Bikini. Mm-hmm. So we had a B-36, a B-52. No, didn't have a B-52 there. Had B-36, B-47, and many fighter types that were going to drop nukes. And so back before the task group formed, the task group commander was going to be a SAC general, Strategic Air Command General, Hal Estes. And he came down and took the people who were going to be in the task group for a briefing. And he said, I want all of you to be knowledgeable of the aircraft we're going to be flying out there. And after this briefing, he just briefed us on things he expected. After this briefing, he said, Jim, he said, I see you've been flying T-33 and B-25. I want you to be conversant with B-36 and the B-52. So go down there and get checked out as a co-pilot in those. And I did. And our B-36 was what we call a featherweight B-36. It was stripped all of its armor, make it real light to fly. It was classified in those days around 60 plus thousand feet, mm-hmm. up almost in the U-2 range. mm-hmm. So I did that. But in doing that, we had the flight surgeon for this task group was the flight surgeon for the base, and at the time, and he took me and we went to Gunter Air Force Base to the super high altitude chamber there with, and were fitted for partial pressure suits. This was the forerunner of what the astronauts are wearing now.
Now, where is Gunther?
Gunther is at Maxwell Air Force, Montgomery, Alabama.
Okay.
It's in conjunction with Maxwell Air Force Base, but it's a much smaller, not an airstrip.
Now, can I ask you how you got, well, do you know why they pulled you out for this?
Basically, maybe my experience
breadth of
in operations,
aircraft.
Uh-huh. Possibly. Because I've been an operations officer back in the troop carrier, and then I was a squadron commander in the troop carrier. And then I was operations officer on Mike, on Ivy rather, and flying safety officer back at Kirtland. Oh, and they sent me to flying safety school, University of California, for a semester. The Air Force contracted with USC,
okay.
just strictly for an engineering course. Well, several subjects, but engineering, aeronautical engineering, basically hit.
Apparently, you were doing well at these different tasks because they pulled you out for this special duty. Yeah.
I was, quote, kind of making a name for myself. And so Colonel Howland, I believe his name was, the flight surgeon, and I got fitted for partial pressure suits. Now this is, as I mentioned, similar to the astronauts, but not near as all-encompassing and as safe as they are. Instead of having the full pressure suit all over us, we had on our lower extremities what we call capstans. They're rubber tubes interlaced with crosses of fabric all the way up the cap, the tube, on both sides of our legs and then up our body and down our arms. And then we had a tight-fitting helmet, very similar to the astronauts. And we had forced oxygen into this helmet. And it caused reverse breathing. Instead of sitting here and inhaling and then exhaling normally, you inhaled by the pressure and you had to push out to exhale.
You had to work to exhale.
To exhale. and to talk.
Did you have did they let you get acclimated to that?
In the pressure chamber.
Okay.
In at 63,000 feet, without any kind of constraint, your body explodes.
Yeah.
And so they took the capstans on these things, on our suits, were basically, if we were to be in a non-pressurized altitude of above 50,000 feet, these things would pop and expand and tighten everything on our legs tight, so it wouldn't come loose. Our body wouldn't come apart.
Okay. So it holds you together.
Very simple. It holds us together. And then we went into the pressure chamber with all of this, and they took us to 63,000 feet and decompressurized, and it popped, and we lived. Mm-hmm. They wanted to take us to 65. Colonel Houghton says, nope. 63 is a maximum altitude. We'll go to 36, and I won't go above that.
Now, how many guys that you know of were in this program?
There were at Kirtland, I think. Uh-huh. No, wait a minute. I apologize. I know of two other airplanes other than ours at Kirtland, and these two were at Carville Air Force Base at Fort Worth. They were configured for nuclear testing in addition to us. And they had gone through the same program that Colonel Houghton and I went through. Mm-hmm. And one of them, instead of our B-36 going to we talked on Operation Castle, one of the Carville B-36s went out there.
Okay.
Now at on Castle, what we had to do, we had an aircraft carrier out there with all good radar on it. And before we went out there, we went down to North Island Naval Air Station, San Diego, with this carrier out just offshore there, and took all the airplanes we were going to fly out in Wetok to North Island, and had them practice with the aircraft carrier radar, spacing them at certain spaces that were predetermined as though they would be the ones that dropped a weapon out on Bikini. This was well before we ever went over for that shot. And
so you would practice the entire shot, essentially.
But no shot.
Without the weapon.
Yeah.
But and what they're trying to do is organize the aircraft in the air, their spatial distribution.
Right. See, each airplane
yeah.
would be in a different space, a different position in space, depending on what the ballistic drop was from the weapon.
Uh-huh.
For instance, B-36 at 50,000 feet would be much longer than F-100 at 35,000 or 40,000 feet.
So the downward trajectory of the
yeah.
bomb would be very different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this was what the practice was about, was to get the crew on the aircraft carrier, along with some Air Force people we put in with them, radar experts, to simulate putting these aircraft in their various positions on a map and then in the air based on on a point on that map. And to practice so that they'd be sure they'd get them in that spot, so the pilots up here would also know what they're going to have to do out at Wetok. So then we go back home in, I don't know, a couple months, maybe a month and a half. We go to Wetok. And General Estes, as I mentioned, was the commander here. I forgot the commander's name on Operation Ivy. I don't remember. But we flew some practice missions there with the aircraft carrier. And then on the day of the shot, 180 miles east of Wetok, Bikini, 180 miles east, the airplanes were all put in their exact position at the exact time the AEC says we're going to detonate this shot. And then when it came off, they all made their escape maneuvers from the point that they supposedly would have released that weapon.
And the purpose of all of that was such that they could measure the impact on each aircraft as
right.
it gets away
right.
at a certain
I should have mentioned
path.
All of these aircraft are instrumented to assure what both the thermal and the blast effect was on them in their getaway position.
Did they have radiation sensors as well, so that they were
did they what?
Have radiation sensors, so you would get
oh, yeah.
how much?
Oh, yeah, all wore dosimeters.
You all had dosimeters
yeah.
on, okay.
And they were checked daily.
I'll bet. I'll bet they were.
Yeah, after a shot. And
wow.
So this occurred, and I didn't, I wasn't involved in the flying activity there, but that morning that they detonated the first weapon on Bikini, I was standing on the runway, on the ramp at Inuitoff at the detonation time, and it looked like a second sunrise, 180 miles away. And then after, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes or so, here came the shockwave. No heat wave, no thermal blast, but the shockwave. I could feel it 180 miles away.
And
very lightly.
Very lightly. So you're standing there. You were okay to stand there through
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do you know, Jim, whether there was a equipment even where you were that was going to be assessed for the impact? Equipment on the ground, or maybe in the water,
mm-hmm.
ships or anything that were going to be that were just kind of sitting out there.
Yeah, they had radiation instruments, test instruments all around. Yeah,
yeah.
They were all monitored regularly.
Yeah,
they had been there ever since before Ivy Mike, because a huge lab island is in the Inuitoff Atoll, and it had contaminated that area pretty seriously. So mm-hmm. that's why they monitored us every day, because this is 2 years later. After that, after the mic blast
yeah.
there, and then we talked.
Yeah.
So they still had the monitoring equipment there for everything on the island, yes. So then the airplanes came back, and my good buddy from the 19th Bomb Group in World War II on Guam was flying that B-36. So I went up to him, his name was Savage, George Savage, but you know, there's an old-time gun shooter named Doc Savage.
Mm-hmm.
So his nickname was Doc. I said, Doc, how was the blast? He said, it was a blast. He said, come back here, I want to show you something. And you know, B-36 has the aft-facing engines. They're pusher-type engines instead of pulling-type
okay.
engines.
Uh-huh.
And they have, on the propeller hub, they have a cone about a foot in diameter coming down to a sharp cone. And they're painted. All that paint was burned off.
Ooh, really? And how far had he been from the blast?
Well, I don't know exactly, but he was in his position as though he had dropped that weapon and then did his escape.
And the heat
and then
just...
When the heat came up, he was going away.
And it still got
him. And it also it had USAF markings on it also kind of singed them, I guess. But
wow!
But that was a good test, though, for us to know that we had escape maneuvers planned for all these airplanes in case we did ever have to go to war, and they would have to do that. That the guys were safe.
Would get out of there.
And if a test had failed, as an example, on any airplane, that airplane would be subject to question. Whether or not it would ever drop a nuclear weapon on the Soviet Union.
Was there any aircraft that was actually eliminated from?
No.
Never?
No.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Well, see, fighters would be the ones would be the closest, and boy, they could
their speed.
Zoom away, full speed. So
yeah.
the B-36, an example, maybe 250 miles an hour in a turn.
Wow.
But it all worked out well.
Now, what were you wearing when you saw that second sunrise?
Just
did you have protective?
Normal khakis.
Nothing else?
Mm.
Your eyes, nothing else?
Mm. Too far away.
Mm. Yeah, too far away, but you felt the shock.
I felt
the
shock.
But, of course, radiation effects probably, you know.
It didn't come
yeah,
over
too,
that far.
Too far.
But the weather forecast and always west, east. Mm-hmm. The weather forecast was not accurate. It changed at, I don't know, before or at shot time, and it just totally irradiated, what was the island's name? Little I, I'm going to say Rotor. No.
Rongelap?
What? Rongelap. Uh-huh. Totally, yeah. Rongelap. And we had an Air Force, small Air Force detachment there, plus the natives. And boy, they were evacuated immediately back to safe ground.
Yeah.
And they had to relocate completely, the natives, in a new environment.
Right.
Of course, many years they're back there now. For many years.
But that was,
it was so hot.
That was an accident.
And it was really an accident.
And that was really based on the poor weather forecasting.
The change, well, I wouldn't say for, but the change in the weather forecast.
That couldn't be foretold, yeah, or wasn't picked up in advance.
Yeah. Right up to shot time, it was still going to go northeast where Roger Lamp was.
Now, just thinking about the experience of seeing a couple of shots. I mean, you saw at least two that you've described. You're watching something that's absolutely, in the case of Ivy Mike, unprecedented.
That's right.
Did it have, what impact did it make on you? Did you think about the, you know, how powerful the United States was, or the science, or did you think about God, or, I mean, what did you think about when you saw
it? I didn't think about the United States in particular, but I thought about, I was always struck, really, mm-hmm. to see such a thing, this thing building up, and what I wanted to do was turn and go away, 9 degrees away, but I couldn't, because the scientists wanted to do their little thing,
right.
So we kept flying.
You had to hold steady.
To it, yeah, until they got what they wanted, and then we went away, but... Now this thing just looked like it was blossoming so fast, coming right at us, that I wanted to go. But my impression, I didn't think about God in World War II I did quite a bit of missions. Mm-hmm. Always said a little prayer, get me out of this one, God, and I'll promise.
Yeah.
But then next, I'll go see it again. Next mission, get me out of this one, God, and I'll promise. But this one, I wasn't really that close. But I thought, yes, I did think, wow, what an impact that will have on the world attitude toward warfare. And that the United States is the only one that has a thermal nuke. Mm-hmm. And we, the Soviet Union already had just plain nuclear weapons.
They had the straight up Hiroshima style, I guess.
Yeah.
Bomb from 1941.
But that was my big concern, was what is the world coming to? What do they think based on this? And what can it do, thermonuke, based on that 28,000 milliton Paul Tibbets dropped on Hiroshima? Right.
Which was a squeak compared to
this. Yes, yeah, I've forgotten the megatons now.
Yeah, I don't remember either, but. The film of that I've seen, which may have been shot from your plane, I don't know. Words fail you. It's frightening. But I cannot imagine having actually been there. You had to hold the plane, as you said, until the scientists got what they needed. How did you know? What was the signal that their tests were complete, they had everything they needed, and you guys could get out of there?
I think basically the cloud, the fireball of the cloud had ascended so far that it was out of their range to, within a confined cabin,
yes,
to get any higher.
They said,
we've got what we want, let's go.
Okay.
It was strictly up to, I forgot the chief scientist's name, we had a board.
Were these AEC employees?
AEC scientists.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So civilian scientists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the photographers were civilian also.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So they would just let you know, we've got what we need.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then after we finished the bikini test, went back to Kirtland again, mm-hmm. and I became the Air Force Special Weapons Center Flight Safety Officer. then. And
what did that entail, Jim? I mean,
trying to reduce the number of aircraft accidents we would have throughout a year. We were based on a year and had a percentage figured in an accident with so many thousand, 100,000 flying hours, mm-hmm. X number of accidents, mm-hmm. equals so much percentage, mm-hmm. and just trying to actually protect ourselves from losing airplanes and people, basically people. And that's what it was all about, was establishing programs where the units that flew airplanes would instill in their pilots, here's what we've got to do, to be real careful.
So setting up, say, SOPs,
yeah.
For certain types of missions?
Yep.
And did you get involved with logistics and supply as well?
No.
Okay, so that whole...
That was strictly up to them.
Okay.
One good example of that, not getting involved in logistics. I came up with a great idea that I saw at some air base. I think it was a SAC air base, and I don't remember where. But they had what they called a rolling command post. Well, back in those days, most command posts were on the base with all kind of... Really, radio equipment and electronics and that type of thing. But this one had all kind of radios and telephones. You know, we didn't have satellites then, so telephone was restricted somewhat. But all kind of equipment like that to help near, at or near the site of a crash. So I came back from that and I kind of designed a vehicle with all this equipment on it that could help the commander at a crash site keep in communication with whomever was necessary through radio, if by telephone, by telephone. And then the on-site, he was the on-site commander of the investigation on the crash. And this solved a lot of problems. But when I designed this, and the commanding officer of the Special Weapons Center, John Canterbury, approved it. He said, send that right on down to the base and tell them to get going with it. So all I had to do was send this drawing down, and not drawing, but specifications.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the base flying safety officer came to me and said, where are we going to get all this stuff? Have fun.
Yeah. I just had the great idea. I'm not here to implement it, right? So implementation became somebody else's.
It's terrible, you know, to be a bureaucrat like that.
That's not my job.
So that wasn't. Well, they had the resources, and
sure.
our center had a higher Air Force priority on personnel and equipment than the supplies than they did. So I told them they could use our priority to get whatever they needed,
okay.
for it, which helped.
They could pull in what they needed. Now, that actually raises another question. Was there any time in this period that you had an opportunity but declined to go to SAC? I mean, okay.
I never asked.
Oh, you never asked. Okay.
I was never asked.
You didn't want?
I would have declined.
Okay. Why is that?
I was just real happy in my job where I was.
Okay.
Had a good job. Environment in Albuquerque. We loved it. Had a good family. General Canterbury and I became real close friends. You can't beat having a general being best friend.
Tell me about that relationship. What can you tell me about his background, first of all?
I don't know. Well, wait a minute. I do know his background.
If you can fill in some blanks.
I'll tell you what. He came there as a commander of a unit I'm going to tell you about in the future.
Okay.
Called AFOP 1.
Called it?
Air Force AFOAT.
Okay.
AFOAT, Air Force. I forgot what the other two letters stood for. But I'll get to that in the future.
Okay.
He was commander of that and then came out as commander of Kirtland. Mm-hmm. And a special weapon, not Kirtland, but the Special Weapons Center there.
Air Force Special Weapons Center. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And then when I became his flying safety officer, he had reviewed my performance on Castle, and the flying safety base at Center Flying Safety Officer leaving. So he called me in and he says, "You were base flying safety officer here, base flying safety officer over there. You want to be my flying safety officer?" I said, "Boss, if anybody up here wants me, that's where I'm at." So that's how I came. His background, let me get to that in another section.
Okay.
Because I go into this outfit he came out of.
Okay.
So I was the center flying safety officer. I had one little anecdote I was going to tell you about that. But maybe I'll remember it. But in the meantime, I still had about, this was 1954. So I had 3 more years to be at Kirtland. I didn't know how long I'd be there, but that's how long I was actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed as a center flying safety officer. And he and I became real good friends.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't know how much you know about Albuquerque, but in those days, in the 1950s, Albuquerque, there's a series of mountains called San Francisco.
Sandia
Mountains.
Just
mm-hmm.
east
sure.
of Albuquerque. Well, there was a long space of miles between the eastern edge of Albuquerque and the base of Sandia Mountains. General Canterbury came to me one day and says, "Jim, several officers are getting an investment group together to buy some of this land out here on the foothills of the Sandia Mountains, northwest of downtown Albuquerque. Would you like to join us?" And I said, "Northwest of downtown Albuquerque, General. Nothing out there but sand dunes." He says, "But wait, it's going to develop." I said, "Let me think about this." So I took the family out. We rode over these sand dunes.
Kids loved it.
No, I bet they did.
Sand, oh, man. I came back, told General Canterbury, "You know, I'm a realist, and I don't ever see any building out there." He said, "Well, Jim, I respect your decision, but you're making a mistake." And I did make a big mistake. We're only going to invest $5,000, but $5,000.
That was a lot of money.
Good. But I wish I could think of other things. Anyway, I finished my time there, and I was a reserve officer. And I applied for, the Air Force opened up an opportunity for long-term reserve officers to apply for regular officer status. I applied to become a regular officer. And at the same time, I applied for assignment to the Air Command Staff College at Air University. I was accepted for both.
Now, what rank would you have been at? This is 1957, if I'm right.
And I was a major.
A major, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I went to Maxwell Air Force Base, to the Air University there, the Command Staff College. And I heard Minnie Mae mention a while ago that a problem in the world is difference in languages. Mm-hmm. But our first block of instruction is the world's greatest religions. And I said to myself, "Religion?
What am I doing?"
So one of my professors, and I said, "Why are we studying religions, especially as the first block? And we're military."
Right.
And he says, "You're going to get into this, you're going to see what I'm telling you right now, but the very basis of war is the fighting among various religions escalating into a war."
That's really interesting. I bet that popped your eyes open. Yeah, right now.
Yeah, right. Look at that.
Yeah. That was very. You must. Did you buy in? Did you accept? Kind of get on the.
Go. After I got in there, I could see it right away. After several other courses combined with that.
Sure. I want to ask you a little more about the curriculum in a minute, but Minnie Mae, did you move then to, and you had two kids by now, is that right? Am I,
or just? There are 4 years difference in our children's age.
And what years were they born?
Well, our son came in after World War II. We waited to start our family after he was working for his dad.
Right.
And we thought we were civilians. So we had our son in October of 47.
And his name is Jim, right? Is he third. Jim Jr.?
Third.
Jim the third. Okay.
And off the record, we have five now.
Okay.
It's ridiculous. But anyway, we have, then we built our dream home and all that, and we started another baby. And she was, I was expecting her in September when he got recalled for the Korean War.
September 51.
What, 51? So I moved back with my mother.
Your mom and dad had a lot to put up to.
They loved it. Mother was a good sport. Daddy put up with it.
That's right.
So we stayed there until Christmas. She was born in September, last spring, September 51. And then he was already in Greenville, South Carolina. So he came for us at Christmas time. And we went back with him. And that was before he went to that survival school.
Right, right.
All that.
So you, when he left, you had been at Kirtland, or in the Albuquerque area, and then when he moved to Maxwell, you also went to Alabama?
Oh, yeah. Our son was going into the fifth grade.
Okay.
And our daughter hadn't started to elementary school yet.
Right.
And I went to our son's teacher, and I said, this worries me because moving around, I don't see how he's going to do well in school.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at me, and she said, travel is very educational. Your son is a bright student, and he makes friends easily, and you don't worry about him. So I took that attitude.
That was probably good.
And she was right. Mm-hmm. And we just did fine. We were there a year.
Mm-hmm.
And we decorated our home. We started a little Cub Scout troop. I was, you know, being mother. And
you pitched in as den mother.
Yeah, and for the year. And the neighbor wasn't going to let her little boy join the Cub Scouts because we're only going to be here a year. I said, are you going to waste a year of your life? I said, don't do that. Just live it.
So, well, that's interesting, and it makes me think about the atmosphere, in the social atmosphere in Alabama around this time. This is a lot of change going on. What can you tell me? And of course, I'm referring to race relations.
That's
I know that you know that. And what? Are there vignettes, or what did
May
you observe?
I'll tell her one story.
Please.
About the city park.
Sure.
They had a big city park.
Mm-hmm.
And downtown was on one side of it, and quite a few of the black people lived on the other side of the park. Excuse me. And one day, I was really upset about this. A young black man worked in town, and he cut across the park to go to work, and they arrested him because he was in the park. And this really bothered me.
How did you find out about it?
Oh, it was all in the paper and everything.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I grew up in Dallas. My daddy had a grocery store. And there were black people. He owned quite a bit of property there. And there were black people on both sides of our property.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not allowed to play with them. But they respected daddy, and he respected them. He helped them when they were without groceries. He called the doctor, and he, you know. And I had no ill feeling toward the black people. And it just bothered me that they were treated the way they were.
In Alabama?
Well, everywhere.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But especially in that part.
Yeah.
Very, very apparent there. You couldn't escape.
Even in Dallas, they had white water fountains and black water fountains.
Yeah.
They couldn't go to our movies. They might sit up in the very top balcony at the big Majestic Theater, but they couldn't go through our box office.
In Dallas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Jim, what do you remember about that year that has to do with the social situation?
Let me digress just a minute from
Please,
that and go back
fine.
To her
sure.
mentioning Dallas.
Yeah.
I don't know how you were, how it was up where you eventually lived in those days, but on our public transportation, all we have are electric streetcars. Mm-hmm. And on each window had a little receptacle, metal receptacle.
Up high,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And they had a little, the motorman on the streetcar had two little signs, one for each side of the streetcar. And a little wooden sign about so long, mm-hmm. a little metal prong on it over on one side. On one side said white, on the other side said colored. And he would put that prong in, leaving about maybe two rows in the back of the car. Uh-huh. And if a colored person, a black person, as they like to be called today, then it was colored.
Sure.
The colored person could not sit forward of that. Mm-hmm. If they did, then they wouldn't move. The motor would stop the car and some way get a policeman and they'd be arrested.
Yeah.
If he was overloaded with white people, and the colored people, seats were all taken, he'd go back and move the sign back, make each colored people get up and stand up, white people take those seats. Mm-hmm. Now that's for Dallas. Mm-hmm. Now let's go back to Montgomery, Alabama.
No, that was Dallas in,
that
say,
was
the...
we grew up.
Oh,
right.
That was, yeah, 40s.
In the 30s. 30s.
30s, yeah. Yeah. Alabama in late 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to what she told you about the black men in the park, one of my professor's wives had a tea party at her home one day and invited certain of our class.
Mm-hmm. Their wives.
And all of a sudden, Minnie Mae was one of them, all of a sudden a knock came on the door and here stands a policeman. And he says, "I have been told that you have a black lady in your home." And she says, "I do. She's my friend. She's attending a tea party of this group from the air base." And he says, "You are under arrest for entertaining a black person in your home. She's under arrest for being here. Come with me." So they did. But the wife, when they got to the police station, called her husband on the staff at the university, who called the base commander and says, "Hey, guy, you got a problem down here." The base commander got deeply involved in a hurry, and that was all hush, 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 mm-hmm. whacked out, never happened again.
You didn't read that paper.
But that was the way it was in Alabama in those days, from a personal point of view.
Wow, that's really scary. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I'm sure, the presence of the base, you know, not only provoked some incidents like the ones you're talking about, but probably also helped push change, too.
It did, yeah. Because we were already being integrated.
Absolutely. Were you finding, Jim, by this point in your career, black pilots coming in?
Coming in, yeah.
Yeah.
Not in great numbers.
No.
But not like they are today, but...
Starting to see that change too.
Yeah,
it wasn't
Tuskegee Airmen type. It was right in with us.
Right, exactly. Not segregated units.
I never had any problem. Just like Minnie Mae said about Dad's
mm-hmm.
store.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to having blacks near, some of the main streets in the near North Dallas. Just the Love Field and all. I don't know how familiar you are with Dallas.
Pretty familiar, yeah.
Northwest Highway runs east and west, just yes. north of Love Field. Some of the main streets in there, big, big homes now, named after some of his, from her father's grocery store.
Customers. Those streets now named
street.
After those families?
Yeah. And some of those families still owe him lots of dollars. When he closed his store.
I could see that happening. I could see that. Well, he gave credit, though.
Yeah,
credit.
But the what I'm trying to say there, based on that, the
yes.
intermixture there,
mm-hmm.
the blacks were not as looked down on in that particular area
yeah.
as they were elsewhere
yeah.
in Dallas.
Yeah.
When I first moved to Dallas from Greenville at the age of 8, I was probably 9 when we actually moved into South Dallas, which... had a section of blacks in it. And we lived a half a block from a railroad track. And on the other side of the railroad track was nothing but blacks. But those of the boys would come over and we'd play together, have fun together.
Sure.
And they never did, seldom ever saw their parents.
Uh-huh.
But I grew up, just like she did, I grew up among blacks.
And right, didn't bother. Never did bother.
Tell her about the sign in Greenville.
In Greenville?
Yeah.
Up until the Civil Rights Act passed, before I was born, Greenville had one main street, had a square, had a couple main streets in it.
Mm-hmm.
But one main street came down across railroad tracks and a depot right on the edge of downtown. Right across this street, it was a two-lane street with parking on either side. And across this street, great big sign, okay, all the way across the street. And about that thick in the width.
So maybe a foot and a half?
Width.
Uh-huh.
And maybe 4 or 5 feet high.
Yeah.
It was all lighted up inside.
Across that street.
And across both sides of it, the blackest land and the whitest people. And that stayed there until the Civil Acts of 1964. And then the city council agreed to take it down. And they set it over on the edge of the depot property. The mm-hmm. depot was out of business, and they didn't train them to stop there. Passenger train didn't. It sat there for, I don't know how many years, several years. It's not there now. But my dad ran a garage on the opposite corner from the depot, uh-huh, right under that sign. I have a picture of that.
Do you really? With your dad's business there?
I have a business. I got a fire plug in front of it.
Oh, okay. Fire plug. Well, that's good. That was important for the business to have that there, too.
But you know,
that's way off of what we're talking about here. But it's important for the world.
It's very interesting.
Let me tell you one other thing about little towns. And I don't know, in Irving, where we finally lived, they had a rule, don't let the sun go down if you're in town.
For African Americans, for blacks?
Well, you're still in town.
Yeah, they had another section there, Bear Creek, they called it. Now it's a very fluent name there, but they didn't, after it got a little late in the day, they vacated Irving. You never saw anything.
I think similarly, there's similar stories about what went on in Lubbock, too.
Oh,
there
yeah,
were certain,
sure,
certain roads you couldn't, if you were black, you need to not be west of the certain
yeah,
road at night. Yeah.
It was pretty prevalent throughout the South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, that's.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I've lived in Atlanta and seen some of the changes there, and I think interesting for us to, you know, for the other observations that you make along the way as you move to different parts of the country, what was happening. I mean, 1957, 58, Dr. King was just becoming a public figure,
that's
and
right,
he did a lot of his work in northern Alabama.
That's
and,
right, yeah.
And,
his march.
That's right. Did you pay attention to him as that was
he wasn't
starting?
Well, he wasn't marching.
Not
he,
yet.
He was preaching and advocating
right,
civil rights, uh-huh, and I don't remember what year. The march was about a year after we left.
Yeah, yeah, I think 59.
Maybe 58,
yeah,
59.
Yeah, somewhere in there. But you know, it's interesting, these things that you observe along the way, because they're kind of touchstones for placing all the rest of what we're talking about into the society from which it came and some of the problems that we had internally as the country. Not to mention, of course, our international issues with which you were involved. But turning to the curriculum at the university, now you mentioned that the first thing out of the chute was this survey of America of all the religions, and this was kind of a new thing for you, although you'd been to all kinds of different training schools and had acquired all these skills. To kind of sit back and soak up all of this information must have been kind of was it a thrill, was it
very
hard work?
It was very interesting. We had a lot of good outside speakers that came in.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. And they verified what this professor had said, that here's why, here's how it happens.
That's interesting.
And one professor, in fact, boy, he really set me off. Now, he wasn't a professor, I'm sorry. He was a, I think he was a lay speaker from some church in Washington, D.C. I don't remember the exact details. He came down and he says, look, he says, you're a mixed group here. He says, you have foreign students here in our religion class. You have foreign students here. You have all, most Americans are Christians. And but you have Muslim in here. You have who believe the Islamic faith. Sure. You have Hindus in here from other countries studying the same thing we were studying. He said, what do you, as a Christian, think is going to happen to your friend right here who is a Muslim, believes Islam, Hindu, Buddhist, I mean Hindu. And then we also studied Buddhism, Taoism. What's going to happen to those people who don't believe in the divinity of Christ and therefore can't get to heaven? Boy, you about to talk about a pop out of the box. Old 26 or 7 year old Jim Hall sitting here. What is going to happen? I hadn't even thought about this.
Had you not? You
no,
had not thought about that?
Well, I didn't know anything.
You were busy. You had a few other things going on. But
didn't know anything except Christianity.
Sure, sure.
I didn't know about those other religions.
That was eye-opening.
Really was. That set me to thinking a whole lot about that. And I was getting another part of that way on down back here. Another
okay.
Assignment.
Okay.
But with a good Islam person. But you asked about curriculum. The world's greatest religions, the Constitution, military regulations, command procedures, how to be a commander without alienating your troops, but still getting the best you can out of them without agonizing or whatnot. And then setting up a staff to help you be a commander, setting up a staff proper to fill it in. All of that was encompassing in the curriculum.
Were they trying to teach you how to both command and to delegate?
Yeah, oh yeah. Delegation is a big deal.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. In the military, you run across two types, the centralists and the non-delegators. And I mean, in delegators. The non-delegators, they're micromanagers. My way or no way,
right.
Out of here.
Right.
And the delegators are, this is your responsibility. I expect you to do it. If you don't do it the right way, the way I'm counseling you, then you and I are going to have a little talk. And we'll give you an opportunity to change your perspective. And if that doesn't occur, then we'll have another talk. It was talking about basically chain of command and how it figures on down to the very basic area.
So that you can be a more efficient operator, presumably at higher. You're at this higher level, and the emphasis on efficiency as well as
that's right. Yeah,
as well as cooperation. I
suppose. General Estes, as I mentioned, SAC commander. SAC. Staff officer who became commander of the Castle Task Group.
Right.
He was a tyrant. He was a non-delegator. My way. This is the only way. This is the SAC way. Well, we weren't SAC.
Right.
So we didn't know about all this.
Did he communicate to you what it was that needed to be done his way?
Oh, yeah.
Was he good at part of it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He'd say, you're going to, example, if he wanted that little sign on that thing turned around backwards. He meant now. He didn't mean, why do we need to turn around
right
now? That's the way. And boy, I was his flying safety officer, and oh my gosh. But I was able to satisfy him. But I didn't so-called brown nose, but I worked my way with his way.
But that's a skill too.
But that's my description. He is a good description of a non-delegate.
Okay. Was the year well spent?
Yes, exactly, well spent. That year, I made Lieutenant Colonel while I was at school based on my previous work. And
I should think so.
It really shook my one of the staff officers up on the staff. He was a major, and he and I had gotten in a couple of entanglements about curriculum at one time. Mm-hmm. And when I made Lieutenant Colonel, he was a major. It just tore him up badly. But in conjunction with that, well, before I made Lieutenant Colonel, I got a letter from the boss between me and General Estes out at Castle that I knew at Kirtland, Colonel Paul Fackler.
How do you spell his last name?
F-A-C-K-L-E-R.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He was in the Pentagon in an offshoot of AFO 1, and I'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And very highly classified mission. And with a very, very high priority in the Air Force. The Air Force probably had 10 or 20,000 priorities, depending on what missions were at various stages, places, and whatnot. We had number 4 out of
all of those.
Out of all of those. The first one was a presidential decree. The second one was war. The third was Joint Chiefs of Staff operation. We were even with SAC. We tied with SAC for 4. Now I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. Jim, can you hold for just one second?
Sure.